Welcome to the F3, Female Forward Finance. I'm your host, Jill Faraday Lloyd, a financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth, and I'm on a mission to help women have agency with their capital. The F3 is a space for real conversations about money, power, and everything in between. You'll hear from experts, entrepreneurs, and everyday Janes about the choices they're making when it comes to their wealth. These are critical conversations because women are earning, building, and shaping what comes next in the world, and it's time we own every bit of our power. Today on the F3, we're sitting down with someone whose work lives at the intersection of storytelling, ownership, and cultural impact. Jenna Siegel is an Emmy, Tony, and Clio Award-winning producer, an impact investor, and the founder and CEO of Gatherer Enterprises. Her work spans Broadway, film, women's sports, and the art world. But what connects it all is a consistent focus on parity, ownership, and amplifying voices that have historically been overlooked. From producing Broadway hits like Hadestown, Suffs, and Six, to being a founding investor in Angel City Football Club, to building the 31 Women Collection as a form of cultural documentation, Jenna approaches capital not just as money, but as a tool for shaping history. In this conversation, we'll talk about how she chooses projects, how she thinks about risk and impact, why ownership matters, especially for women, and how she defines legacy across both tangible and ephemeral worlds. Welcome to the F3, Jenna.
Thanks so much for having me, Jill. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so happy. It's been a long journey for me to get you in front of the mic.
Well, I'm sorry about that. It's been very busy.
Thank you for being so busy. Before we dive into all the incredible work that you're doing, I really want to talk a little bit about, you know, what shaped you, what guides you, right? Before you worked as a producer, a collector, an investor, what, you know, can you share a little bit about who you are as a person? Because I think that that backstory informs where we are today.
Sure. So I grew up in New Jersey.
Jersey strong.
Only the strong survive. And I'm an only child, and my parents always instilled in me I think on my dad's side, you know, you can do whatever you want to do as long as you work hard enough for it. And on my mom's side, she was a teacher. She had really wanted to be a book editor. And at that time, you really had two choices. You were either going to stay home or you were going to be a teacher, a nurse, or maybe a secretary. It wasn't called an executive assistant at that time. And with the secretaries, it was even usually, post having children when you wanted to go back to work, which my grandmother did. Both my grandmothers worked. So I come from a long line of working women. It was women's rights and women's equality have always been something that was extremely important to me. I always wanted to see more women's voices at the tables. And I grew up at a time where politically you were really starting to see that, at least in the political spectrum. It was a time where there were more women coming into Congress. There we had a much more vocal first lady, whether, you know, you love Hillary or not was irrelevant to the fact that you had a first lady who had a voice.
I remember Geraldine Ferraro.
Yes.
I remember going to a lunch in New Jersey with my mother.
Yes, Jersey. Jersey girl. Yes. Yeah. And that was a big deal. I think we probably don't talk about her quite as much because she didn't win, not that she didn't win, she wasn't running for president, but as vice president she didn't win, so she often gets kind of left out of the that conversation. But it was just a lot of momentum towards women could do anything, and that just really stuck with me. So I was at CNN, and I was working in what I like to refer to as the first ever reality show, which was the Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky scandal, as they used to refer to it. And I thought, if I'm going to do entertainment, I may as well do entertainment. And I picked up and moved out to L.A. I was immediately hired by MTV because I think, especially at that time, having that news experience and just knowing how to hustle was incredibly valuable to the team that was out there. And I moved more into the background production, where I was handling the finances of a individual production for pilots. So producers would come to the development team with their story ideas. They would decide if they were going to do the show or not. And then they would come to me and I would do the budgets and I would help put together all the logistics of creating whatever the pilot was, a pilot being, you know, the first ever episode of a show that you're going to do. And we did everything. It was crazy. As you can imagine, MTV in the 90s, like, we were just throwing everything at the wall, seeing what would stick, seeing what didn't. I was seeing the beginning of, you know, videoed skateboarding and trick biking and dropping people from onto ramps out of helicopters and motocross and just stuff I had never been exposed to growing up in the Northeast. And it was a lot of fun. I learned a tremendous amount. And I realized when it was time to go and moved back to New York, and decided that I was going to go to business school. And so I was in the midst of applying, and September 11th happened, and the world just kind of changed, and I wasn't sure that I really wanted to leave anymore. And, of course, the typical story, I met my husband. Again, during that time, we went to high school together. And then I didn't want to leave him. And so I stayed and wound up back within Viacom for a show at Nickelodeon called You Pick Live, which was the first ever interstitial talk show. And what they thought was going to be happening in the world was that we weren't going to have commercials anymore. And so what do you do when you have cartoons, which you can run again and again and again, but they all have commercial breaks, is nobody thought that you were going to be able to just run through a commercial break with a blip onto the next episode. You would put in these interstitial shows that would serve as commercials, and they'd be 2.5 minutes long. And we did this live show for Nickelodeon where all different celebrities would come in, and it was a ton of fun. It was hysterical. And we built that show over, I guess I stayed there about 1.5 years, and then I moved to a digital network within Viacom called Nicktoons. Was there for about 1 year. Went back to MTV for a little bit, and then I got pregnant with my first son. I said I was going to retire. I tried really hard. I stayed home for 2 years, and it was just very clear at that point that I was going to need to be, I hate saying working mother, because I think it is really hard being at home. And it is a ton of work.
I ask women, I always ask women, do you work for money? You know, like,
I think
that's the most respectful way to ask somebody if they have a job outside the home.
Yes, I like to say, one of my jokes is, that's what I get paid the no bucks for, like when I can figure out something very easily and people are like, that's a great idea. I'm like, that's what I get the no bucks for. I was really glad and grateful to be home for those 2 years. But I clearly was starting to search for something, I don't want to say more, but different.
Yeah, it sounds
something
to me
that
like
was for me.
That, you know, you went through 9/11, so you were out doing the Jackass kind of, you know, MTV stuff.
Definitely around all of that, yes.
And then you were in cartoons, and then you have a kid. And life really changes
yes.
for women when they have children. So was that the genesis of you starting to think a little more purposefully or intensively about the mark you want to leave on this earth, besides your beautiful children?
You know, I think that's really an interesting question. And I remember I would say at the time that I felt like people weren't accounting for what I would refer to as like post-traumatic shock of having a child and being at home, having been a busy woman working in the world, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden that goes quiet, and the only thing that you have is like feeding and a crying baby. And yes, these moments of like wonderful, you know, specialness, but not the intellectual burst of dopamine hit that I think you get when the person you've been waiting to call you back for that deal that you thought you were going to make, or, you know, the person who's you're waiting to call you because you did something wrong, or you did something that needs to move, or you just need to move forward. And, you know, those little, I can only imagine it's worse now because of phones. You know, we're all constantly looking to see if we got that next email or that next text. And then you really had nothing. It was just a blackout. I mean, there were no iPhones.
Yeah.
It was, you either had a BlackBerry or you had, you know, a flip phone.
Or you had a dog. Like, I had a dog. That was the only way that I met other women, was I'd be out walking the dog or
yeah.
in the playground with the daughter. You know,
I definitely had the dog. I wouldn't even say I was meeting other women. I was meeting other dog people,
yeah.
for sure. And
I did
get this great group of new mom friends. And then I lived in New York City, and a lot of them moved. So I think that that's one of the interesting things too, is that I think people used to, I don't know if this is true or not, but I think many people used to like buy their home in their community and they'd stay there for years. And with women working now, you often will spend more time trying to hold on in that area close to wherever we're working if we didn't move out to the suburbs. And so then you wind up, your whole infrastructure and your whole system of people that are holding you up when you first have a child, just immediately your village disappears kind of overnight to whatever different place they're going to wind up, whatever different suburb or different town. And I kind of looked around and was like, wow,
this,
you know,
is lonely.
2 years in. And it's interesting. I've never really thought of it that way, but you're probably right. It was at that point. I don't think I was thinking that I was lonely, but I think I was thinking that I needed to have a little bit more say in my own narrative. And I had met a couple who owned a theater. And I was telling them that I had this dream that I wanted to produce Gigi on Broadway as a musical one day. And they told me they do more experimental theater, but they knew tons of people who are in the theater business. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this could be a cool thing for me to just kind of start looking into. And honestly, I don't think that there wasn't an intention that I was going to produce a big Broadway musical within the time period that I had started doing it, but I don't think I had really accounted for the fact that I was a producer and I knew how to produce. And it's kind of hard when you know how to do something to not keep moving something forward. And that is really, to me, what producing is about. And that was what I wound up doing. So it, you know, I learned it from scratch. I was the only person in the GP on that, which what you learn is there are lead producers and then co-producers and then investors in Broadway. I was a lead producer on my own, and then I had co-producers who were investors and other people that I was working
this
with
on it. This is your very first
ultimately
play.
It was my very first
And
play.
You did Gigi.
And I did Gigi, yes. So the reason that I think now I'm so conscious, and I'm going to correct you about one thing, is that I'm an investor on Six. I'm not a co-producer on Six. But the reason that I always make sure to say that is because I'm very, very respectful of how much it takes to be a lead producer on a show and how much work that takes. And just recently, another woman that I've known for a long time came up to me and said she had just done her first show as a lead producer with two other partners. And she said, I feel so bad I did not support you. I really had no idea how hard this was.
Okay, so that's what you need, really, you know, because there's so many women on whose shoulders I stand.
Yes.
Right? And yes. I've tried to make it my purpose to snowplow for lots of women who are coming behind me. Yep. And I really admire that about what you're doing with the work that you create, but also the work that you support through the not-for-profit work that you're doing. And I want to talk about that in a second.
Yes.
But I want to get back to this idea of everything you've learned, right? All the producing, all the budgeting, all the filming, all the casting.
Right? Yeah.
Like, so you used this phrase with me of that movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, as a description of your life. Let's bring that out a little bit.
Yes, and I think that that is something that I think I thrive in that environment. The more that I have on my plate, it was really something that I learned in college, was the less I had to do, the more I was like laying on the floor, listening to that sad song, crying my eyes out, or like having my roommate walk in and I'm like watching, you know, some sort of, you know, tearjerker movie, and she's like, why are you doing this to yourself? And it's like, because I'm bored. Yeah. Like, I can't stand being bored. I need to be on my feet and busy, and not busy in, like, busy for busy's sake, but learning busy. I like to be constantly learning. And I think that's why I really had to focus on what is it that makes me really invested and interested in what it is that I'm doing. I would say the key to that is the women piece, making sure more women are on a list for, hey, we need women on that panel. Who, you know, who do you know? And I can pull up a list of women who have done that thing. You know, if women aren't given the chance to do that thing, then they can't be on the list as doing that thing. So I like to invest in things that always have at least one woman in a decision-making capacity, because that's one more woman that is on the list, whether it's my personal list or whether it's the list at UBS or it's the list at Broadway or the list off-Broadway. No one's hiring a director who's never directed on Broadway before. And, you know, does it happen? Of course it happens, but much less often than usual. And so, you know, you have to take as many swings at the bat, right? That's the baseball reference. I don't know why I'm using a baseball reference. I don't really care about baseball. But you know, you have to just give people enough chances so that they can start succeeding. And from a business perspective, it's without question that women just don't get that opportunity. What, 2%, right, of VC money, and that keeps going down, is going to women? Like, of course they're not going to succeed. How many times can a man get VC money for a business that fails, right? And they're not like, oh, he had 15 businesses that failed and the one that hit, but women aren't getting even the one chance to fail. And so I guess that's really how I look at what I'm doing in entertainment or what I'm doing in some venture, which I think I'm putting more of a toe into. I'm invested in Yola Mezcal, which is a female-run beverage company that somebody had bought me. I love Mezcal, and she bought me a bottle for my birthday and told me, oh, it's made and created by women, and that's, you know,
that's all you need.
She knew it was something.
Right?
And I was like,
you have me
who runs
hello.
This? Oh, I like this. Who runs this? And I picked up the phone and called them, and I was like, are you taking investors? And, you know, I wound up investing with them. And that is really the thing that I look for, because at the end of the day, for me, the things that I'm working in are very risky. That's just the reality. And so if I am going to take the risk that I'm going to lose the money, and that is the thing with entertainment that I think most people need to really understand and know. It's like, it's not like a stock where your money goes down a little bit, but you could always just trade it and, you know, get them,
yeah,
get the money
liquid.
Back. This is like, you know, 100 or zero. Like, there's very little in between. Or, you know, with Broadway, you can put money into something and you maybe can get 50% back, or maybe you get 1,000% back, or maybe you get 0% back. Mm. And so, you know, you have to go in knowing all of those things. When you get 0% back, it's not great. And how many times are you going to do that, right? And so for me, what I had to frame it as is I am investing in women. And any time that a woman's work gets onto that list, that gets onto, that gets a Tony, that gets onto the list of having done that thing, whether I've made money or lost money, I have won. But, of course, when I make money, then it's amplified that much more. And I think a great example of that would be Angel City Football Club, where I got a call from a good friend, and he said, you know, it's all about women. I want you to invest in this. And he's like, but you're going to lose all of your money. And I was like, oh, great. You're
Why
speaking
me?
My language. I was like, I thought you were the person who was supposed to call me when, like, to make money. And at the end of the day, we did. We more than doubled our money. I think it was 2.5 times within 5 years, which was amazing and a miracle.
Yeah.
And everyone says to me, you know, what teams are you going to invest in next? And I'm like, honestly, I think I struck lightning with that one. I'm not sure that is, you know, I feel confident that is going to be what I'm investing in next.
Although I'm a big fan of women's sports and the whole infrastructure that is being built, and I think there's going to be some great opportunities.
I 100% agree with you.
But that may not be for you.
At the same time, I am 100% for women's sports. I am 100% not an athlete. I am 100% not really somebody who even... if you say to me, hey, I have tickets tonight to go see the Knicks play, or, you know, Gotham FC, because I'm in New York right now, I'm going to be like, I'm good. You know, it's just not something that I really need. Ironically, absolutely love any movies or TV shows about athletes. I don't understand
You're
why.
A sucker
I
for...
like I like the... the psychology of it. And
well, it reminds me a lot of you, to be honest. Yeah. First of
all,
the curiosity that you have that says, I'm just going to get started. I mean, I might suck at this, but I'm just going to, like, I can do this. That's what athletes say every day. They wake up and they fail and they wake up and they fail and they wake up and they fail until they start building something meaningful.
I'm not sure I can fail that many times in a day.
Well, you do. We all do. I mean, the point is perfection is unachievable, right? So by that description
Don't tell
alone.
My mother.
Because she thinks you're perfect?
No, because she expects perfection.
Oh, God. Okay.
She'll be
well,
very mad at me saying that, and she'll definitely listen to this.
But I really admire this notion of I'm curious, I'm going to learn, I'm going to get started. And that's the theme that kind of
yes.
keeps going through your career.
Correct.
Right? So
yes.
I want to move into sort of how you pick a Broadway show, for
sure.
example. And what's important to you? You did mention that they need to have at least a female writer or director. But and in that, where does supporting women on other levels come into play? Maybe mentoring and your capacity to mentor at this point.
Sure. So Broadway, just quickly, of course, it starts with, is there a female writer or director? The second piece is, so if there isn't, it's an immediate no. That actually makes it a lot easier because I'm able to, you know, cut out a lot of what is sent to me. Then if there is, the next step would be, is there a script? And I read the script. If I am not captivated, honestly, within the first 5-10 pages, it's probably just not going to be right for me. Or if it's a musical, then, and they have, you know, a few songs, I listen to the songs, and if I like the music, then great, and if I don't like the music, then I'm going to say, yeah, this isn't really right for me.
So is there a formula that you look at, or is it really just how it
really
moves you?
How it moves me, and I would say, you know, Hadestown and Six are perfect examples of that. In that both of those shows, Hadestown, I listened to, you know, a recording from a pre-show before they went to London that was sent to me by a fellow producer and actually someone I partnered with on that show investment. And I was like, wow, this music is amazing. And I remember at the time feeling like this is just something that washes over you. And I still feel I've gone to see the show, you know, obviously many, many times. And it doesn't even matter who's performing in it anymore. It just is spectacular and just like this incredibly wonderful, beautiful show. Six, similarly, you know, heard the music, went to see it. Everybody in the audience, and this was in Chicago, was like rocking out. They knew the words already. My niece was like, had heard it all on TikTok and was singing every song, and she hadn't even seen it yet. And it wasn't on Broadway
oh,
at the time.
So
and I was
cool.
like, there's something to this.
Yeah.
And so I brought my husband, and it wound up that it was one act. And he was like, this was fun, and there was no intermission. Best show ever. And so I like begged to invest in it because there were so many people who wanted to. And finally some, you know, the producer gave me a little piece and I'm still grateful.
That's
like it was
awesome.
Just great. And both of those shows are still running, have recouped, have continued to send checks. You know, are great shows that I have no fear of recommending people to go to. What I can say is that since Gigi, I have been extremely hesitant to raise money from other people because I wasn't able to recoup on that show. And I think that that's probably my next hill to climb is I had so much conviction. And so I felt completely comfortable asking people, to invest their money. And, when I closed the show, you know, there are a couple of, men who were producers on the show with me who were like, get back out there, get back on the horse, start raising money. Come on. What do you want to do? You're great at leading this. Like, I want to do something else with you. And I just was broken. I couldn't take money from anyone anymore because I felt it was so personal to me that I felt like these people had invested. They didn't invest in the show. They invested in me. And I didn't live up you know, to their financial expectations. 10 years later, when I see the number of men who were coming up in the producing ranks with me who just kept
failing.
Doing it, and they would, I hate to say failing, you know, because, like, look, if you get a show on Broadway, it's a miracle.
Yeah.
It is so hard to get a show on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And so if you do it, and I don't know if I'm allowed to curse here, but it's like, you got a fucking show on Broadway. Like, you didn't fail. It's amazing that you did it.
Yeah.
But you might not have been able to return people's money. And finally, I have started to understand that with art, the people who are investing in art, particularly in theater, because as I use the word ephemeral, it's so ephemeral that you don't have something really to hold on to. And that is really what led me into art collecting in an interesting way, is that I, during COVID, decided I wanted to tell the story of Peggy Guggenheim, who I had really been fascinated by for years. And obviously, it was very difficult to make anything in theater, film, or television during the period of COVID. I went back to her autobiography and read about this period of time during World War II where she had a gallery in New York City called Art of the Century, and she did the first ever all-women's art exhibition in the United States. And it was a juried exhibition with Marcel Duchamp and Max Ernst and Barr from the MoMA and Peggy, and they curated 31 women artists that that they wanted to be seen at this gallery. And I thought it was interesting because I started, you know, Googling and looking online and just could not find anything about these women or anything about the exhibition, or certainly wasn't in the history books in the way that I would have anticipated a first women's exhibition to be. And so in my particular way of being, well, I'll just try this, I decided, let me just find the list of who the women were. Found the list, and then it was, let me just see if I could collect one piece by each woman, and, you know, that would be enough. And 5 years later, there's a collection. I have a collection called the 31 Women Collection. It's over 300 pieces of art plus ephemera, which is letters and postcards and things that you wouldn't necessarily consider to be fine art. It was curated into a new exhibition that started in Madrid and then moved to Lisbon, Portugal. It's just recently been returned. And much like Peggy, which is really interesting, in 1946, she did a second exhibition by 31 women with some different artists, and then she moved back to Venice. I actually have the office that was my office's Art of the Century, which was Peggy's gallery.
I mean, what is, that's the crazy
obsessive
thing.
Obsessive, yeah. Yes. And it's just a funny story of being obsessive and during COVID, like being so immersed in these women and trying to learn about them. And I literally just walked up to the door of the building because I knew what building it was in and knocked on the door, and Lloyd answered, and he said, can I help you? And I'm like, can I just see the sixth floor? And he's like, okay. But, you know, I was like, this really incredible historical exhibit happened there. And he's like, okay, fine. And it was just like this, you know, kind of old office with like cubicles and old carpeting. And I was like, do you think they'd let me rent it? And he said, well, I'm not sure. Let me give you the number. And I rented it. And 6 years later, unfortunately, they're knocking the building down.
Aww.
And so I am going to have a last hurrah 80 years after the last 31 exhibition. And, you know, 80 years after Peggy, I guess, went and moved back to Europe. And it is interesting. I think there's always these interesting mystical signs that kind of pop up that I'm never really expecting. But she was turning a page in her life. The war was over, and she was going back to Europe. I'm turning a page in my life in that I'm going to be an empty nester next year, which I was not expecting either. And so we just moved into a new office, but we're going to do this one last exhibition for by invite to celebrate what was there and the experience we've had over the last 6 years and how amazing of a journey it's been, and it really has been an incredible journey.
But this, you know, the stories repeat themselves.
Correct.
I don't know if you see this.
Yes.
Your curiosity, your determination to truly understand stories of women, then the risk you take,
yes,
to put the stories out there, your risk of your time, the risk of your capital, right? And it is all in the act of telling women's stories.
It is. And I think it's because I get really irritated by how hard it is to find historical stories about women. And it really is an archaeological dig to discover some of the unknown stories by women. And you really have to have a tenacious spirit, somebody mm-hmm. once told me, like a dog with a bone where you just mentally cannot let go of that thing.
But I also, I really appreciate the way that you are telling these stories in a sustainable way as a business model.
Yes.
So I said, do you feel comfortable being called a matron of the arts?
Yeah.
And you responded very strongly to that. So let's talk a little bit about collecting and
yes.
philanthropy and the difference between the two.
Okay. Right? So I have a good friend, and she believes very strongly in the word matron of the arts. And it's interesting, even though I collect the 31 women, I'm asked often, to put the 31 women in a museum that's all women, or different things that are about all women. But what I have learned about most of these women is that they said, I don't want to be known as a woman artist. And that was 80 years ago. And Peggy and, Duchamp, and they convinced these artists, with the exception of one, Georgia O'Keeffe, to be in this exhibition by 31 women. Georgia O'Keeffe said no. She said, I'm not a woman artist, I'm an artist. And I intentionally want to loan this, the work and the collection wherever it wants to go and be known as the 31 women collection. But I don't want it to be in a museum that is just women, because I have, particularly in the exhibition in Portugal, where they do this amazing a way of displaying art at the Max CCB, where the new exhibitions are in the middle of their core collection. So you have to walk through existing art to get to the new exhibitions. And in this case, you are walking through all art by men, mm-hmm. and then you walk into the middle of this exhibition, and you don't even realize anymore, because you've been completely immersed by this art, by all these men, that you're walking into three rooms of work that are all by women. And it's you're not just walking straight to that. Like, I'm going to walk towards work that is all by women. It's like you're just walking through art. And I loved how it took the viewers out of that space of thinking about it as women. And so I think, given that I know so many of these women didn't want to be known as women artists, I try to get them in the spaces that men are in as well. I want to make sure that they are remembered, but I want to make sure they're remembered because one of the things that I feel, as you said, about things happening again and again, is that because our stories are not recorded in history, or I say sharpied into history, like a Sharpie pen with permanent marker, because women's stories aren't recorded into history, women keep feeling like they're the first to have ever done something. And so there are some women who, I think, Jill, like you and I, who were really taught we stand on the shoulders of the women who came before us, and that was really kind of, I don't know about you, like how that got ingrained for you, but it was very ingrained in me, was that there were women that were there before me. And so for the generations that are coming up, if you're not, if that isn't being ingrained in you, and you're not having a place to start to find out about the women who have done the thing that you want to do, it's a really lonely journey. And I want to make that journey a little less lonely for any woman who needs a story of another woman to aspire, that they're aspiring to be, to have those stories out there so they have those examples. So to your point, you know, they can see it to be it. And it, I think then it becomes less of a challenge to make those things happen.
Beautifully said.
Thank you.
I have sort of one last question.
Sure.
Because I'm very curious how you balance profit and impact in your investments of all types.
Sure. So I would say that when I invest, and this is a really funny thing that I'm finding, I invest with you, Jill, also, full disclosure, but I, you know, also have investments with other companies. And because of what I'm so interested in, people often come to me and say, we know you want to invest with just women. And I'm like, no, that's actually not true. Like my work, the thing that I work on is things that are investing in women. But when I'm investing my money, then I want to invest in what I think can give me the best returns. And I really look at that as two separate things. And some people might, you know, not be able to fully comprehend that. But there's kind of no way right now. Maybe there is. But if you're going to invest all of your money and decide to really have a complete gender lens around what you're investing, there's no question that you're going to most likely not make the returns that you would make if you're investing like any other man. And I don't think that women should disadvantage themselves at this point in time by not investing with men at all. I think that when you have, you know, your cash that needs to go into the market, then you should have it be in the market in the best way to make those returns happen so that you have more money to pay forward whatever it is that you want to be doing. So when I make extra money from being in the market, then I have more money to go and invest in one more show.
Your risky ventures.
Buy another, you know, artwork or a few artworks by, you know, the women that I collect right now. And, you know, Jill, similarly, what we said, like, I don't only buy art by women. I only collect the 31 women artists. So I see collecting as the passion and the narrative and the story that I want to be telling with this art that I'm putting together. But when it comes to buying art, I consider art as an asset. And any art that I buy is art that I would be okay with selling. That is very different from the art that I collect. The art that I collect...
Is your legacy.
Is my legacy, yes.
Yeah. And so what's the hope for that legacy?
I think that's really undetermined. And because I think it's still a living, breathing thing, this collection. And so I would say I'm now in a majorly exploratory phase. But I guess my biggest hope is that this doesn't get lost again. So how do I make sure that this story gets told? So that it is, again, sharpied into history and that it's sharpied into art history, that anybody who is studying art history for your, you know, $80,000 a year art history education to walk out of a university in the United States and not know that the 31 women happened, and not know who, you know, any of the artists are other than Frida Kahlo, you know, is really a disservice to me. And I'm working to make sure that that is something that is remembered, and that would be the legacy that I hope to achieve.
Oh, it's a beautiful legacy. What's the best way for our listeners to learn more about you and the work that you're doing so that we can support you?
Well, thank you so much for asking. Gatherer Enterprises is the name of my company. There's a website under gatherenterprises.com. The 31 Women collection is listed under that, so you can explore each of those women or Google it. There's been a lot of different articles about it. We're on LinkedIn and Instagram, and there's really a ton of ways to learn about the women through that. And personally, I'm in the process of writing a book about my own journey on how I collected Peggy's collection, exhibition by 31 women, and the journey that I went on, because it really started on eBay. So it is something that
anybody
is
can
accessible.
Do.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent.
Be curious.
Yes.
Get started.
Just, yeah.
Take
make
reasonable
your first,
risks.
Make your first purchase.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
It was beautiful. Thank you, Jenna. This has been such a powerful and helpful conversation. It's about your ability to tell stories, but also tell the stories of other women telling stories about ownership and about what it really means to build impact over time. But what stands out to me the most is how intentionally you connect art and capital and legacy. Whether you planned to do it or not, there's a real through line in all of that.
I'll let you know in a decade.
But, you know, you made it clear that those aren't separate lanes, but a part of a single long-term vision, which is still coming together. There is no perfection, which we talked about before we got on the mic. But thanks for sharing not just what you do, but how you think, and for reminding us that who owns the story often determines which stories endure. And thank you to our listeners for joining the F3. We'll see you next time. Onward.
That's it for today's episode of F3, Female Forward Finance. If you found this conversation valuable, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and more importantly, share it with another woman who could benefit. If you'd like to stay updated with insights, resources, and exclusive content, join my mailing list by emailing me at jill.lloyd@ubs.com. Until next time, keep building, keep growing, and let's make those financial dreams a reality. Onward.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.